quality sounds, tune into CKUT 90.3 on the Frequency Modulation Band Radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
It's summertime. Time to hit the road. Hit that Trans-Canada Highway. Past the nation's capital, past the sleepy cows, and into the peaceful pastures of Wakefield, Quebec. For the first time ever, Swanee Peril Popolo presents a day of revelatory offerings in an historic farmhouse, Fairburn House, bordering the Gatineau River in Wakefield. Saturday, June 25th, music begins at 3:30 p.m. On the bill, Swanee Heartstoppers, Esmarine, Willie Mitchell, Nada El-Shazly, and Eliza Caution. For tickets, directions, camping, and all the 411, go to swanneeperilpopolo.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Hey, inu hatik ei tunga sorettit ukiu taktunut heilauretit. Join us and traverse on the expansive tundra with our show, Tupituhak, a one-of-a-kind circus production brought to you by Tupik Act. Tupik Act is a non-profit organization comprised of young Inuit artists telling our stories through contemporary circus. And we're inviting you to watch Tupituhak this Sunday, June 19th at the McCord Museum. You can't miss this show as you can purchase tickets for 11 a.m., 1:30, and 3 p.m. You heard that right. Three shows in one day. Indigenous people have free admission. Tupituhak, a thrilling story of intergenerational reconnection and newfound powers. Become enveloped as we transmit our stories right onto the stage. Merging reality and the magic of the tundra, this is a collaboration with CKUT, and we can't wait to see you there.
Thank you. This is the CKUT Radio at 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah Hassanin. It's time for the Mosaic Show. We'll start with some news headlines and local Montreal stories by Alice Wu. You're listening to the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. This is the Mosaic Show. I'm Sarah Hassanin.
My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. 26,000 of Quebec's civil servants are going on a week-long strike this week. These employees are technicians and office workers for different ministries, agencies, and courthouses in the province. They have worked without a contract since March 31st, 2020. On the right to use a minority language like English in internal communication. And this Sunday, 50,000 cyclists participated in Tour de Lille, Montreal's annual bike festival. They took a 36-kilometer route through closed-off streets through several Montreal boroughs. The event was at maximum capacity for the first time since 2019. And Canada now has 70 vaccines to close contacts of infected individuals to slow the spread of the disease. My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. More than 200 people hiked up Mount Royal for Saturday's Spirit Walk, an annual fundraiser for the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal. The shelter surpassed its goal and raised $65,000, which will go towards a housing project for Indigenous women and children. The building will include a center offering Indigenous-led health and social services and legal aid. And 26,000 of Quebec's civil servants are on strike this week. These workers are technicians and office staff for various departments, agencies, and courthouses in the province. They have already gone on strike twice this year. This is a correction from earlier when CKUT said that the strike was going to take place last week. And on Saturday, Ontario removed most mask mandates, except in long-term care and retirement homes. Organizations can keep their internal mask policies. And now for some news you can use. The Native Women's Shelter of Montreal is organizing its annual Spirit Walk. It's to raise funds for the shelter's projects supporting Indigenous women and children. The walk starts at 1 p.m. on Saturday, June 11th at the Mordecai Richler Gazebo next to Mount Royal. For more information on how to register, visit the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal Facebook page. And Community Cooks Collective is looking for volunteer drivers who would deliver meals to centers serving low-income and unhoused individuals. If you have a car and want more information, send a direct message to the handle Community Cooks Collective on Instagram. And the St. Ambrose Montreal Fringe Festival runs until June 19th. It's an annual multidisciplinary arts festival where tickets are capped at $15 and artists receive 100% of revenues. For more information on all the shows, visit the official Fringe website at montrealfringe.online.red61.ca. The Fringe Festival is also providing free outdoor performances in Parc des Amériques starting June 9th. And now for some news you can use. The community-based music festival Swoney Peril Popolo began last week, featuring experimental songs in many genres. The festival is at La Sala Rosa on Saint-Laurent and continues until June 29th. For more information, visit suoniperilpopolo.org. And the Festival des Musiciens du Monde starts this Thursday. This year's program blends the sounds of Afghanistan, Brazil, Japan, and more, and includes free family workshops. The festival runs June 16th to 19th in the church Saint-Enfant-Jésus on Saint-Dominique. For more information, visit centredesmusiciensdumonde.com. And Montreal's Mural Festival is here. International graffiti artists have transformed Saint-Laurent with vibrant wall-sized artworks. You can check them out from now until next Sunday, June 19th. For more information, visit muralfestival.com. Je m'appelle Alice Wu et voici quelques des gros titres récents. 26 000 fonctionnaires québécois feront la grève le long de cette semaine. Ces employés sont des techniciens et du personnel de bureau pour différents ministères, agences et tribunaux dans la province. Ils ont travaillé sans contrat dès le 31 mars 2020. Et la Commission scolaire English Montréal est devenue le premier groupe à porter plainte devant les tribunaux de la loi 96, qui modifie la Charte québécoise de la langue française. Selon la Commission scolaire, cette loi est inconstitutionnelle pour empiéter sur le droit d'utiliser une langue minoritaire comme l'anglais dans des communications internes. Et ce dimanche, 15 000 cyclistes ont participé à Tour de l'Île, un festival annuel de vélo à Montréal. Les cyclistes ont suivi un chemin de 36 km de rues fermées aux voitures à travers plusieurs arrondissements montréalais. L'événement était à capacité maximale pour la première fois dès 2019. Et le Canada a maintenant 77 cas confirmés de variole simienne, à compter du vendredi 3 juin. 71 de ces cas sont au Québec. La province a commencé à fournir des vaccins antivarioliques à des contacts étroits des individus infectés pour ralentir la propagation de cette maladie. Je m'appelle Alice Wu et voici quelques des gros titres récents. Plus de 200 personnes ont fait une randonnée de Montréal pour la Marche de l'Esprit de samedi, une collecte de fonds annuelle pour le foyer pour femmes autochtones de Montréal. Le foyer a dépassé son objectif et recueilli 65 000 $ qui financeront un projet de logement pour des femmes et des enfants autochtones. L'édifice inclura un centre offrant des services sociaux et sanitaires ainsi que de l'aide juridique. Et 26 000 fonctionnaires québécois font la grève cette semaine. Ces techniciens et employés de bureau travaillent pour différents ministères, agences et tribunaux dans la province. Ils ont déjà fait grève deux fois cette année. Ceci est un rectificatif de la déclaration précédente de CKUT que la grève aurait lieu la semaine dernière. Et dès samedi, l'Ontario ne requiert plus le port de masque, sauf dans les facilités de soins de longue durée et les maisons de retraite. Des organisations peuvent garder leur politique interne concernant les masques. Et maintenant, des nouvelles directement applicables à votre vie. Le foyer pour femmes autochtones de Montréal aura sa marche de l'esprit annuelle cette fin de semaine. C'est une collecte de fonds pour le foyer, dont la mission est de soutenir les femmes et les enfants autochtones. La marche commencera à 13h ce samedi 11 juin au pavillon Mordecai Richler, près de Montréal. Pour plus d'informations sur comment vous inscrire, visitez la page Facebook du Foyer pour femmes autochtones de Montréal. Et le Festival Saint-Ambroise Fringe de Montréal aura lieu jusqu'au 19 juin. C'est un festival annuel d'art multidisciplinaire dont les billets coûtent un maximum de 15 $ et les artistes reçoivent 100% des revenus. Pour plus d'informations sur les représentations, visitez le site web officiel Fringe qui est montrealfringe.online.red61.ca. Le festival offrira aussi des spectacles gratuits à l'extérieur dans le Parc des Amériques commençant ce jeudi 9 juin. Et le Community Cooks Collective cherche des chauffeurs bénévoles pour livrer des repas à Résilience Montréal et à la Porte Ouverte. Ces deux organisations servent la communauté à faible revenu et sans abri de Montréal. Pour plus d'informations sur cette opportunité de bénévolat, veuillez envoyer un message au compte Community Cooks Collective par Instagram. Et maintenant, voici des nouvelles directement applicables à votre vie. Le Festival communautaire de musique Suoni per il Popolo a commencé la semaine dernière, présentant de la musique expérimentale de plusieurs genres. Le festival a lieu à la Sala Rosa sur le boulevard Saint-Laurent et continuera jusqu'au 29 juin. Pour en savoir plus, visitez suoniperilpopolo.org.
et le Festival des musiciens du monde commence ce jeudi. La programmation de cette année mélange les sons de divers pays comme l'Afghanistan, le Brésil et le Japon. Il y aura aussi des ateliers gratuits pour toute la famille. Le festival aura lieu du 16 au 19 juin dans l'église Saint-Enfant-Jésus sur la rue Saint-Dominique. Pour plus d'informations, visitez centredesmusiciensdumonde.com. Et le festival Mural de Montréal est en cours. Les artistes internationaux de graffiti ont transformé le boulevard Saint-Laurent avec des œuvres vibrantes couvrant des murs entiers. Vous pouvez les apprécier dès maintenant jusqu'au dimanche 19 juin. Visitez muralfestival.com pour en savoir plus.
Canadians are divided about Law 96. Some are thrown off with frustration and anxiety, while others totally support it. Take a listen to what some people think about Bill 96.
As with Bill 21, Bill 96 calls for the most sweeping use of human rights overrides in the history of Quebec and Canada.
So, as a French speaker, as a French native speaker, I'm really convinced that we have to reinforce the law 1-to-1, and I'm sure that we really need to do that now. But
coming up next, here's an interview with Mr. Quentin Dufresne, a French journalist who resides in Montreal. And in Quentin's interview, we'll get to talk about several interesting issues, especially regarding the issue of the refugees of the Uyghurs in China. You're listening to the CKT radio at 90.3 FM, and this is The Mosaic Show. I'm Sarah Hazanin.
Hi.
Hi, all good?
Yes. Quentin, it's a pleasure to have you on our show. So how's it going?
Well, it's pretty good, like starting the summer pretty well, busy with work and projects, but pretty
good
so far, I think.
So tell us a bit about how you decided to become a journalist and a filmmaker.
Well, at first it wasn't obvious that I'm going to become a journalist because I was doing scientific studies. I was at Université de Montréal doing a master degree in psychiatric research. And halfway through, I realized it wasn't for me at all. I was lacking this social experience, this social element, the human connection. And I started looking at what I was like really enjoying in life, and progressively, like, it started to be obvious that I wanted to do journalism, that it was journalism, the good answer to my questions. And so I started looking up, and I found this diploma at Concordia. And so I started the graduate diploma at Concordia University while I was finishing my thesis. And here we are.
Okay. And what stories attract you the most as a journalist?
It's definitely the stories about minorities, refugees too, and around the concept of resiliency too. How experiences in the past, negative ones or even positive ones, like how you digest them and you use them positively and you learn from them. And so I try as much as I can to integrate those topics in my stories. But that's definitely, I'm more into social journalism and solution journalism too.
Is there anything in your own personally lived experiences that actually drew your attention towards minorities, refugee stories?
Sure, yes. Well, I'm a gay man. So I grew up in France, in the country. It wasn't easy to grow up as a gay man and to be like, developed as a gay man. And I realized like how when people are more aware, when people know more about someone or topic or community or minority, people are less judgmental, they are less negative and critical about it. And so definitely I had this like desire of informing people of of like kind of teaching people about like minorities, so in that way they are more aware, they're more conscious, they are less intolerant, they are more tolerant though, and like and in that way I do really believe that like we can decrease at least like racism and xenophobia, homophobia, discriminations by just teaching people more about, you know, destigmatizing and like helping people to understand others.
All right.
That are different from them.
Okay, so that that's how your lived experience has inspired you to cover stories about minorities. Mm-hmm. And when you started working as a journalist, getting into the real life kind of job, are you disappointed or are you happy? Like how do these things work in reality? Do you find that the media scape is as open as it should be to such stories?
Yes, I do feel now like since like, I don't know, like a few years, I will say like there is more awareness toward minorities. For example, the LGBTQ2+ minority, by community, sorry. Also with the BLM movement, like I feel we're in the middle of like a social transition kind of. There is more awareness toward gender issue. There is more awareness toward like diversity in general. So I do feel like there is a bigger I don't know what to say, like like definitely in the news, we do have more like stuff about like minorities and there's more awareness. So there is more papers to cover them. And in my practice, like I do my own like work too. So like I'm writing like op-eds, opinion letters, or like this documentary or in my personal work. I do integrate those topics, and I do hope like in the future when I'm going to be like in a bigger institution, I will be able to treat that topics.
Okay, so let's go now to your documentary film, No Road Back Home. So what's the film about?
Road Back Home, the entire title is No Road Back Home, The Helplessness of the Exiled Uyghur. Uyghurs, and that's important to say the second part because like so the Uyghurs is like a Muslim minority located mostly in Xinjiang, so it's like the east the western part of China. Mm-hmm. Since like decades, almost a century, they are oppressed by the Chinese regime, the CCP, the communist Chinese regime, and like there are like a lot of like Western countries identified that as a genocide. A lot of people compare it to the Holocaust too, because there are extermination camps, like there is like sterilizations, forced sterilizations. There are murders, there are like, a lot of things. And so like in this documentary, we see three Uyghurs, exiled Uyghurs, one activist, one mother who was here with just one of their other children.
Yeah, the woman who immigrated to Canada with her daughter. There's one woman who came with her daughter to Canada.
And another one who's actually now in Paris, and like she spent more than 15 months in a concentration camp. So our documentary was more, I co-produced it with Jessica Wu, and we focused, like there's a lot of coverage on Uyghurs, but like in China, the one who are in China, but there is a lack of like awareness toward the Uyghurs who exiled, and who are in another country right now, and they are definitely like helpless, like they have no like support or from government, but also like they have no connections with their relatives back in China, and there are like they receive threats from the government, the Chinese government, even though they are in Canada or in France and the States. And they're not that many neither who want to speak out loud too. So we wanted to focus our work and to make this documentary about the exiled Uyghurs and their helplessness and how they're struggling to survive, to keep going, as well as trying to protect and do what they, whatever they can to protect their family back in China.
Right. So when you were filming No Road Back Home, the helplessness of the exiled Uyghurs, tell us about the challenges that you had to face while filming.
So like definitely like it was an interesting documentary because like it was made during a pandemic. So we managed to film in person interviews with two of the three characters, but with like all the sanitary rules respected and everything. One of the characters was in France, so we had to interview her over Zoom, and she was speaking in Russian. Both of us were not speaking in Russian, so it was kind of a challenge, but like Kayum Masimov, the activist we interviewed, helped us to translate. A big thing was the emotional part. For example, when we interviewed the mother, the Uyghur mother who is in Montreal now, it took me a few days to recover from that experience, that interview. Like, definitely, like, it was really, really intense emotionally. And like, you know, like this documentary is like a short doc, so like it's 15 minutes, but we had like at least 4 hours of rush with her, and there is way more than what she said in the documentary. Way, yeah, really intense stories, and it was really hard to you know, to hear and to, because when you read something about that topic on in the news or everywhere, like you're still like, you know, it's tough.
It's still remote. Really, you feel you're empathizing vicariously. It's still remote from you, but in this film, yes, you felt like you were getting involved personally.
But like, we're trying not to be too much, but like when we interviewed like her, for example, like it was really intense because she was in front of me, like still like distance, but like still she was like in front of me, looking at me in the eyes, and it was really, really hard to hear those stories, but like we needed to hear them. But I had to took a lot on me to be able to manage, to keep the interview going on. And but it's like, yeah, all that topic of like, you know, we speak about crime, we speak about like rape, we speak about like children missing, like we speak about like, you know, it's really tough like subject. So it was really hard emotionally for both of us to do the interviews, and even after for the editing, you know, like the editing process takes a long time. So always hearing the stories again and again, like, was really tough, but we made it. And but also a tricky, and not a tricky, but like it was important to keep our characters safe too, because like China is like really good at tracking people who are speaking too loud about like the regime. So we made sure to, and she asked for it, but like we made sure to keep like the mother, the Uyghur mother, anonymous, so she's not putting herself in danger by speaking, but also her family back in China. So there were a lot of like challenges during that, that filming, and yeah.
The question that comes on my mind now is, what is your takeaway from this experience? With regards to self-discovery, what have you learned from this experience?
Well, I learned a lot about like, but like about the topic for sure, because every time, and it was something really, really hard to experience too, because every day, even though I did my research before starting filming, etc., Like every day I felt that I discovered something new about the Uyghur genocide. So every day, you know, like new stuff, new horrible stuff. And so I learned a lot about the topic. I learned about a lot about the community also, the way like the CCP is working. But I also learned like how, you know, like Uyghurs, like exiled Uyghurs, are people like you and me, you know, like they are like people like everyone. But maybe you have one Uyghur, exiled Uyghur, who got his family killed, or I don't know, his children missing, and he's your neighbor, but you don't know it. So I wanted to make also like, yeah, like I feel even more aware about like how, like, you know, like those kind of stories, you can find them everywhere, even in, at your neighbor's door, you know, like, so, but they're here, they're strong. And I think I learned a lot also like humanly, like how human can support a lot of things and still be resilient, like those people. So, yeah.
Right. So the story covered in this film is basically alluding to an Islamophobic regime, right?
Yeah.
So how do you see a common ground between Islamophobia and homophobia from your point of view?
Well, those are discriminations. So that's definitely what like made them connected for sure. After like, I don't know. I try to see all these discriminations, like homophobia, discriminophobia, like transphobia, everything like as just ignorance. And the people who treat that these communities that badly, like, are not like aware, like there is a misunderstanding about like human, I don't know. For me, like all discriminations are just like based out ignorance, but like ignorance is like rapidly solved. So if you open books, if you watch documentaries, you speak with people, you are less ignorant too. So I don't know if it's just ignorance, but like I don't know. I heard some stuff, I seen the news, like some like accounts of like social medias in China were like erased because it was like LGBTQ people and stuff like that. So, but like, I don't know, like if there is a, I don't know what would be another connection between homophobia and Islamophobia, but.
I do agree that ignorance is a strong connection. I think that the driving force here, the motive here is that here's someone who is different from myself and from what I may have learned. And that's why I'm going to start bullying them. I'm going to start, basically there's fear, right? So if I'm ignorant about a community or a group of people who are different from me, then there is fear. And fear can sometimes lead people to be hurtful.
Mm-hmm,
I think that's, yeah, that's basically it. And at the same time, the fact that numbers also speak. So the fact that these are minorities, it gives the majority the message that we are entitled, kind of. We're entitled to be in control, and we're simply going to run the show the way we like, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's about domination. So it's like the domination of majoritarianism versus minorities, and it's just driven by ignorance and fear and eventually hatred and harm.
Mm-hmm,
so I do think, yeah, there's a lot to be shared between homophobia and Islamophobia, and that's why like you have the word phobia, right, in both terms.
Mm-hmm,
so okay, so how, like, journalism, do you think that journalism is enough to tackle these issues, to see the change we're hoping for, we're dreaming of in our societies?
So I don't think journalism is enough. Like for sure, it's a big element toward for the fight against those discriminations, like for like toward the Uyghurs. For me, like journalism helps to make people aware by informing them and with like you know facts and objectively as much as we can. But then it takes also like the citizens, like the general, like everyone, like every human, like has to be touched by it and like to move. For example, for the Uyghurs topic, like about the genocide, like I think 90% of the Chinese cotton is like is from Xinjiang, so the area where the Uyghurs are and the concentration camps too, and it's forced labor too. There is forced labor a lot there in the concentration camp, and so Uyghurs are used to pick the cotton too. So all the clothes you buy at Zara, all the Nikes or all those stuff
brands,
and big brands, big brands are Uniqlo, for example. It's a big one too. The cotton from China was literally picked from Uyghurs. So like if you go to Uniqlo, Zara to buy a t-shirt or underwear or whatever, like with cotton made from China, so which is a lot of clothes, unfortunately, your t-shirt was made from from a Uyghur person, forced labor, forced to pick the cotton. Probably dead now, or a kid, or a child. So people have to realize that, like, you know, with mass consumption all the time, even more in North America, with like a lot of capitalism too, we have to stop like all the stuff. By I don't know. Personally, now I'm trying as it's hard, but like I'm trying to boycott as much as I can Chinese products. Because I don't want to participate in that thing. I don't want to buy a t-shirt that was made from like, which the cotton was picked from a Uyghur person in the concentration camp. So just like journalism makes people more aware, but after people have to like help, like the people have to act.
Start acting, exactly, to make a change.
Make a change by making all other people aware about who are the Uyghurs. That's the thing, like people have to move for it and stop going to Zara, stop, so they're going to understand. And at one point, like I think H&M was involved in the Uyghur cotton, the Chinese cotton thing, and but they withdrawn their contract, like they stopped the contract with the CCP, so like with China. So they got boycotted back in China, but that we don't care. But at least they stopped, you know. But Uniqlo, Zara, all the stuff are still doing it. A lot of big brands, to be honest. I just think few, but like there are a lot of brands that everyone is using now and buying from. So yeah, I think journalism is important to make people aware, to do that research, investigation, interviewing people with powerful stories, showing that to the world, but then the world has to act.
And one good step is to actually stop taking part in this exploitation game. So when you decide to stop buying these t-shirts and commodities from big brands, then at least we're doing our part.
Yes, at least. After, we also need like governments to take actions too. Like few governments officially recognized, like in February or January, like I think it was February, like the American government recognized officially the genocide, the Uyghur genocide. Canada was going on too, the parliament recognized it, but not like the government yet. So we need to move, like we need to make the governments aware, and they are aware, but like
it's not enough. We need to do more.
It's not enough. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, my last question here, you mentioned that one of the actors starring in your film, the woman, the mother of the child who lives in Montreal now, she's concerned about being exposed or targeted by the Chinese regime. So what actually made them get into this film? What is it that encouraged them and motivated them to participate in this film despite the risk?
They want people to be aware. They want people to know who they are. They want people to know what's happening in Xinjiang, in China, but also out of China. For example, she explained us, we didn't have enough room to put everything in the documentary, but she did explain us during the interview that like she receives phone calls or messages to say like, yeah, come to the Chinese embassy, or threats. Like I spoke with a Uyghur, another Uyghur was in charge of URAP, like an organization for Uyghurs' rights. And he explained to me like last year or two years ago, like he went to speak at the Canadian Parliament to explain what's happening and everything, and to make like parliamentarians aware. And an hour before getting there, he received a phone call saying that like he's a terrorist, he has to die, his family is gonna die, his mother there, like in China, is gonna be dead if he speaks. But that's like one out of like, they all receive threats. Mm-hmm. They all receive threats. So they receive threats toward them, but also toward their relatives. Like the CCP is literally taking their relatives in a stage. Like, because if they phone someone in China, like imagine like this mother wants to phone her parents, mm-hmm. If the parents respond, like the call is like just to receive a phone call from overseas is enough for the government, the Chinese government, to take you and to bring you into jail and then like concentration camp. And that's like, that's how it works. So like they receive all the time threats, and also if they try to reach their relatives or friends, like they're putting their relatives and friends in danger. So like it's a constant thing. So that's why like we had to protect them. Like the activist was okay. We asked all the time like if they were okay to be identifiable or not. But like the mother, like yeah, she has like kids, like several kids still like in China. Her parents, she didn't have news since a few years. And that's terrible. That's terrible.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Quentin. And I'm sure your work and the work of many other journalists should actually yield social change, the change that we're all dreaming of having, hoping for.
Definitely. And I thank you for having me. And also, I invite everyone to come at the our documentary is projected, is going to be projected at the Festival Cinéma Sous les Étoiles. Okay. Not this, but like the Tuesday 27th of July.
The Cinéma du Parc, is that the one?
No, it's cinema, it's a festival, it's a film festival. Uh-huh. Cinéma Sous les Étoiles, it's in Montreal, and it's going to be at 8:45, and it's on July 27th. You need to register before, but it's free, and you can watch this documentary with other people, and it's a film festival. So I invite everyone to come, and yeah.
I'm going to actually take this information down again, because as I edit this interview, I will be actually sharing this data, all of these details about the event. Mm-hmm. So you said it's the Cinéma des Étoiles?
Cinéma Sous les Étoiles.
Sous les Étoiles, and that's in Montreal, right?
You can find it on my Facebook.
Yeah, and it's July 26th, and it's at 8:45 p.m.
July 27th, it's a Tuesday.
Oh, July 27th, and they have to register for it. It's free, though.
Perfect. Yeah, it's free. Okay. They just have to register online.
Yeah,
to book their ticket.
I'll definitely spread the word, yeah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay, thank you, and the best of luck. I wish you all luck.
Me too. Excited to listen to your project. Good luck for the editing too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. I'm just gonna. And finally, I'm gonna leave you with some of the best Egyptian and Middle Eastern hits. Till we meet next week, it's all the best for me, Sarah Hassanin, for the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. This is the Mosaic Show.
See you next week.
وقت غروب الشمس واقف على البحر بعيد عمال بحكي له واشكي له واشرح واعيد فجأة لقيتها وكنت فاكرها عروسة البحر خارجة من المية وطلتها أقوى من السحر لما شفتها قلبي دق تلات دقات والطبلة دخلت لعبت جوا دماغي حاجات لما الرق دخل قلبي رق وحنيت طب هعمل ايه رحت انا غنيت امتى الحب
Nu har det galt. Dunger så rigtigt. Okay, tak, du nu taler rigtigt. Join us and traverse on the expansive tundra with our show, Dupiduhak, a one-of-a-kind circus production brought to you by Dupik Act. Dupik Act is a non-profit organization comprised of young Inuit artists telling our stories through contemporary circus. And we're inviting you to watch Dupiduhak this Sunday, June 19th at the McCord Museum. You can't miss this show as you can purchase tickets for 11 a.m., 1:30, and 3 p.m. You heard that right. Three shows in one day. Indigenous people have free admission. Dupiduhak, a thrilling story of intergenerational reconnection and newfound powers. Become enveloped as we transmit our stories right onto the stage. Merging reality and the magic of the tundra, this is a collaboration with CKUT, and we can't wait to see you there.
It's summertime. Time to hit the road. Hit that Trans-Canada Highway. Past the nation's capital, past the sleepy cows, and into the peaceful pastures of Wakefield, Quebec. For the first time ever, Swanee Peril Popolo presents a day of revelatory offerings in an historic farmhouse, Fairburn House, bordering the Gatineau River in Wakefield. Saturday, June 25th, music begins at 3:30 p.m. On the bill, Swanee Heartstoppers, Esmarine, Willie Mitchell, Nada